Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, October 17th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland Memorial Starts Plans to Add Office Building, by Mella McEwen, business editor. Midland Memorial Hospital's plans to remake its campus were presented to the Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday. The Midland County Hospital District and Debbie Parchman Reese requested a zone change from PD, Planned Development District, for a medical center in part, and O1, Office District in part, to PD, Planned Development District, for a medical center and hospital on 23.93 acres at Kent Street and West Michigan Avenue. The request was unanimously approved with the stipulation that the project comply with the city code ordinance determining the minimum number of parking spaces. The zone change was sought in order to expand the PD boundary, expand the existing hospital, and construct a new medical office building with new parking. The applicants have also submitted a request to vacate a portion of North End Street and the alley. The preliminary plat was approved by the Planning and Zoning Commission in May. The submitted site plan shows the proposed infill of the courtyards and expansion of the third floor of the existing hospital campus, a new medical office building, and additional parking. A future garden is proposed to be located near the northwest corner of the new medical office building. The south tower will eventually be demolished. One hurdle for the project is obtaining Midland City Council approval to vacate the portion of N Street and Alley. In other news, new shopping opportunities are on the way as commissioners approved plans for a shopping development at 300 West Longview Avenue. Lila S. Pilarisetti requested the zone change from PD, Planned District for a Shopping Center, to RR, Regional Retail District. The zone change will allow for construction of a 4,000-square-foot white-box development, in which the interior will not be finished out until space is leased, and then it will be finished to suit the tenant. Teresa Lane also received approval for her request for a specific use designation for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a restaurant. Her restaurant, The Lounge, is currently under construction at 5606 Starboard Avenue. Proposed hours of operation are Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. and Friday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to midnight. Proposed alcohol service hours are 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. the next day. Sitting as the Airport Zoning Commission, commissioners approved a request to amend the Airport Height Hazard and Compatible Land Use Zoning Map that was implemented in 2014 when Midland International Airport received its spaceport license. The revision would discontinue the northeast departure trajectory for potential launch and re-entry flight paths, as studies showed any potential vertical takeoffs and landings would occur to the south or possibly northwest. This article is entitled Library Books, Community Standards Policy, On Midland County Agenda, by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. There are items regarding library books, a Midland County Community Standards Policy, and the Library Advisory Board on Tuesday's Midland County Commissioners' Court agenda. Item number 23 on Tuesday's agenda is, quote, discuss and take action on Midland County Community Standards Policy, unquote. The agenda item was created by Precinct 4 Commissioner Diane Anderson, according to county documents. County officials said that commissioners will go into executive session prior to agenda item 23, and there is a chance it does not get discussed on Tuesday. The plan of allowing Midland's community standards to inform where certain books should be in the library has been discussed by county commissioners before. On August 14th, County Judge Terry Johnson said, "I think we allow the public, the community standards that exist here in Midland, Texas, to decide what they want in the library and what they don't want in their library." Precinct 1 Commissioner Scott Ramsey said that the Commissioner's Court meeting Tuesday will be terrible and expressed concerns with the proposed Midland County Community Standards Policy. According to Ramsey, this Midland County Community Standards Policy mimics the Texas Penal Code standing regarding books in schools. Basically, it takes all those items that's in the Texas Penal Code, it puts them in this policy without any reference to the Texas Penal Code, Ramsey said Monday. In addition, Ramsey said that in this policy, books that are identified and reconsidered to be moved from the young adult section to adult sections of the library will be brought to the library director. After that step in the process, according to Ramsey, the Midland County Community Standards Policy bypasses the Library Advisory Board, and the title is brought to County Judge Terry Johnson or his appointee, Ramsey said. That person can do anything with the books that he or she wants to do, Ramsey said. It's all subjective. Is this book sexually explicit? Well, is it or it's not? Well, if this person thinks it is, they can do whatever they want to it. Ramsey also discussed that the Texas Penal Code and Midland County Community Standards Policy prohibits titles that include references to self-harm. So, any book in the library or in the under 18 section that references suicide can be removed? What if it's a self-help book, where either you're trying to prevent suicide or you're trying to help some person whose family member or friend has committed suicide? So those books have to go away, Ramsey said. Item number 24 on the agenda for Tuesday reads, quote, discuss and take action on book list, unquote. While agenda item number 25 states, quote, discuss and take action on the following books in the children's section at the library, unquote. And then identifies Dead End, All Boys Aren't Blue, Assassination Classroom, Flamer, Identity, A Story About Transitioning, The Fire Never Goes Out, This One Summer, and Undead Girl Gang. Those books are on the book list, Anderson said. I don't know how things are going to go. If X works, then we don't have to do Y and Z. But if it doesn't work, then we have to do Y. And if that doesn't work, then we have to do Z. Given the possibility that the Midland County Community Standards Policy may not end up being discussed on Tuesday, County Judge Terry Johnson preferred to not do interviews on the matter until after Tuesday's session. The Commissioner's Court will meet at 9 a.m. Tuesday in the Midland County Courthouse. This article is entitled, Midland ISD Adds Another Superior First Rating, by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. Based on data from the 2021-22 fiscal year, Midland ISD earned an A from the state of Texas. Midland ISD has received a 98, or superior rating, based on School's Financial Integrity Rating System of Texas, FIRST, reporting. The information was part of Monday evening's school board meeting at Bowie Fine Arts. The meeting included a public hearing about the report. This is the sixth straight year Midland ISD has achieved an A rating. The 2022-23 first report data is lagging, and based on the 2021-22 fiscal year, Midland ISD reported in its agenda packet. The district received a score of 98 and a rating of an A for superior achievement. Midland ISD also reported that the goal of the first report is to achieve quality performance in the management of a district's financial resources. The report provides transparency to the public of anticipation of future financial solvency for a school district. Each school district must prepare and distribute an annual financial management report, and the public is allowed to comment on the report at a public hearing. The rating system uses 20 indicators. In addition, 6 disclosures are now required along with the report. 1. The superintendent's employment contract. 2. Reimbursements received by the superintendent and board members. 3. Outside compensation and/or fees received by the superintendent for professional consulting and/or other personal services. 4. Gifts received by the executive officers and board members and first-degree relatives, if any. 5. Business transactions between the school district and board members. 6. Additional information that the district's Board of Trustees deems useful. Midland ISD's loan blemish came from the question, was the number of days of cash on hand and current investments in the general fund for the school district sufficient to cover operating expenditures? The district received an 8 out of 10 on this question, as current liabilities was less than 3 times the amount of current assets. MISD First Ratings 2022-23, 98. 2021-22, 96. 2020-21, 96. 2019-20, 100. 2018-19, 100. 2017-18, 92. 2016-17, 72. The source of these figures is Midland ISD. This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, October 17th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midland Memorial Starts Plans to Add Office Building, by Mella McEwen, business editor. Midland Memorial Hospital's plans to remake its campus were presented to the Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday. The Midland County Hospital District and Debbie Parchman Reese requested a zone change from PD, Planned Development District for a Medical Center in part, and O1, Office District in part, to PD, Planned Development District for a Medical Center and Hospital, on 23.93 acres at Kent Street and West Michigan Avenue. The request was unanimously approved with the stipulation that the project comply with the city code ordinance determining the minimum number of parking spaces. The zone change was sought in order to expand the PD boundary, expand the existing hospital, and construct a new medical office building with new parking. The applicants have also submitted a request to vacate a portion of North End Street and the alley. The preliminary plat was approved by the Planning and Zoning Commission in May. The submitted site plan shows the proposed infill of the courtyards and expansion of the third floor of the existing hospital campus, a new medical office building, and additional parking. A future garden is proposed to be located near the northwest corner of the new medical office building. The South Tower will eventually be demolished. One hurdle for the project is obtaining Midland City Council approval to vacate the portion of N Street and Alley. In other news, new shopping opportunities are on the way as commissioners approved plans for a shopping development at 300 West Longview Avenue. Leela S. Pilarisetti requested the zone change from PD, Planned District for a Shopping Center, to RR, Regional Retail District. The zone change will allow for construction of a 4,000-square-foot white-box development, in which the interior will not be finished out until space is leased, and then it will be finished to suit the tenant. Teresa Lane also received approval for her request for a specific use designation for the sale of all alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a restaurant. Her restaurant, The Lounge, is currently under construction at 5606 Starboard Avenue. Proposed hours of operation are Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. and Friday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to midnight. Proposed alcohol service hours are 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. the next day. Sitting as the Airport Zoning Commission, commissioners approved a request to amend the Airport Height Hazard and Compatible Land Use Zoning Map that was implemented in 2014 when Midland International Airport received its spaceport license. The revision would discontinue the northeast departure trajectory for potential launch and re-entry flight paths, as studies showed any potential vertical takeoffs and landings would occur to the south or possibly northwest. This article is entitled MISD Approves Bond Advisory Committee by Stuart Doreen, staff writer. The Midland ISD Board voted on the formation of a Bond Advisory Committee at its Monday meeting. The committee will provide accountability and transparency through the oversight of Bond 2023, should voters approve the bond referendum on November 7th. This advisory committee was talked about during meetings of the Bond Planning Committee prior to the board approving to put the bond on the November 7th ballot. Midland ISD reports the committee will be made up of leaders who either served on the Long Range Planning Committee or the Bond Planning Committee, and other community and business leaders. Coincidentally, of the 13 people that have agreed to serve on the committee, 10 are listed as supporters of the Energized Midland Schools Political Action Committee. Another has publicly stated his intention to vote for the bond referendum. That means at least 11 of the 13 are working toward the passage of the referendum. This oversight committee will meet at least quarterly to hear reports on construction and project timelines, cost of projects and finance reports, as well as communication and marketing efforts to communicate the ongoing work until every last project is complete, MISD reported. The first meeting would be at the end of November 2023. Midland ISD has reported the following people have agreed to serve on the Bond Advisory Committee: Austin Beam, Jeff Beard, Abraham Beagle, Adrian Carrasco, Ashley Colquitt, Amanda Day, Whit Groves, Josh Hamm, Jack Harper, Denise Norman, Sam Sledge, Ronnie Scott, Danny Wesson. This committee will then present to the Bond Planning Committee at least once a year to provide the committee members with an update and provide the Board of Trustees a final report when all projects are complete, the district reported. In addition to this committee, the district will work with Park Hill to manage this project. The district will work toward getting a project manager to help oversee all construction work to ensure the highest quality of work. Early voting for the November 7th election is scheduled to begin on October 23rd. This article is entitled, "The Tailgate Owners Grilled Over Expansion Plans," by Mella McEwen, staff writer. Planning and zoning commissioners were asked to consider three specific use designation requests from the Tailgate at North Big Spring Street and West Loop 250. The Tailgate co-owner Sean Elphick explained that the requests were an effort by the business to get into compliance with zoning ordinances, as the facility has grown and evolved from just being a food truck park to hosting concerts and other events. City staff were grilled on whether or not the Tailgate could continue to operate if the requests were denied. It could, but only as the original food truck park. Staff was also grilled about the parking, which has been a frequent complaint about the facility, along with traffic. Left turns are not allowed, as well as trash and noise. One speaker, who owns property across from the Tailgate, applauded efforts to bring entertainment to Midland, but complained that people going to the Tailgate would park on her property and cross Big Spring, which left her open to liability issues as well as trash issues. She also criticized the fact that there is only one way in and out of the Tailgate, saying that could hinder first responders should there be a mass casualty event. Commissioners were told that once site plans for the Tailgate expansion were received, then the staff would calculate the number of required parking spaces. Elphick told commissioners he and co-owner Ariel Herrera have plans to expand the site and are working with code enforcement staff to get into compliance. They also stressed in response to a question that they do hire off-duty police officers and security officers. Commissioners approved by a 4-1 vote a request for a specific use designation without term for amusement, commercial, outdoors, to allow for concerts, ticketed events, cook-offs, private events, and charity events without a temporary land use permit. The designation would bar the use of amplified sound without a temporary permit. A request to amend the original specific use designation for a mobile food vendor park to expand the occupancy limit from 400 to 1,000 was also approved by a 4-1 vote, as was a request for a specific use designation with term for the sale of alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption in a mobile food vendor park and an amusement commercial outdoor facility. This article is entitled, "U.S. Oil Drillers Show Signs of Pivoting from Shale to Offshore," by David Weth and Devika Krishna Kumar, Bloomberg. The latest evidence of a pivot by oil explorers from U.S. shale to offshore appeared Monday as the U.S. Energy Information Administration warned that a drop in onshore production is accelerating into November. After revising its own figures from previous months, a decline in oil output is now expected to gain speed in every month from September through November, when combined production from the seven biggest shale fields will fall to 9.6 million barrels a day, according to Monday's report by the U.S. agency. The Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico continues to lead the contraction. Reports of a shrinking shale patch come as total U.S. output soared to a record 13.13 million barrels a day last quarter. U.S. Gulf production was almost 2 million barrels a day in July, according to the most recent data available. That's up 4% from the previous month and 11.7% from the same period a year earlier. As shale growth slows, deepwater drilling is enjoying a renaissance, with more than $500 billion in global offshore investments expected through 2025, according to the oilfield services giant SLB. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, What Exxon Deal Says About Future of Texas Shale. $60 billion acquisition of Pioneer sets stage for more deals by major players. By Amanda Drain, Houston Chronicle. Oil companies looking for new petroleum-rich plots to tap are hitting a wall in the Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico. The desirable Tier 1 shale that yields ample oil at relatively low cost and minimal technical challenge is largely spoken for. That's a challenge for a company with the size and ambition of ExxonMobil, which plans its growing production decades ahead, and was a key factor in the spring-based oil giant's $59.5 billion bid to buy Pioneer Natural Resources. The deal, Exxon CEO Darren Woods said Wednesday, pries open access to, quote, the largest undeveloped Tier 1 inventory in the Midland Basin, unquote. They're not thinking about the next 2 to 5 years, but 10, 20 years, said Wood Mackenzie shale analyst Ryan Duman. So to refill the hopper, so to speak, takes big deals like this. And this firmly moves them into the number one spot with regards to not only Tier 1 inventory, but total inventory. The mega deal, which is expected to close next year, would make Exxon the largest operator in the Permian, securing it decades of inventory in a time when the future of the nation's most prolific oil basin is uncertain. Squeezing oil from Permian shale could get harder and more expensive in the years ahead for those who run out of higher quality source rock. I think everybody in the room kind of understands where the Permian sweet spots are. Ezra Yacob, CEO of Houston-based oil company EOG Resources, said during an investor conference last month, according to a Capital IQ transcript, and that rock is getting drilled up. The declining availability of quality inventory is drawing lines in the oil patch, separating big players, such as Exxon, from smaller ones that are seeing a shortening runway, analysts said. This sets the stage for consolidation, as merged companies can more easily weather the higher costs necessary to meet engineering challenges associated with trickier source rock. While supermajors operating in the Permian Basin have enough quality inventory to last an estimated 25 years at the current pace of drilling, private exploration and production companies would have around 11 years remaining at the current pace, said Matthew Bernstein, a senior shale analyst at Rystad. If these companies start drilling again at 2022's pace, Bernstein said, you're going to exhaust that inventory in a shorter period of time. For some E&Ps, that could be 5 years or less. The moment calls for either a new discovery or new technologies capable of more efficiently extracting tight oil and reducing the financial burden. Meantime, the hunt is on for less desirable Tier 2 shale resources, said Toti Larson, principal investigator at Bureau of Economic Geology's Mudrock Systems Research Laboratory at the University of Texas, which specializes in shale research. He said he is seeing growing interest from oil companies in finding what's left after the prime targets are taken. This category of source rock tends to be more rich in clay, posing drilling hazards, and rich in natural gas and water, which require additional infrastructure and cost to handle. The real question now is, how can we continue to make this economic, Larson said. You can't overlook the importance of water disposal and excess gas. Still, the basin holds vast amounts of crude waiting to be accessed for those willing to invest the time and money, said Carr Ingram, a petroleum economist for the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. Plus, Ingram said, a disruptive new technology could always come along. I think everybody's pessimistic about a new technology that's as revolutionary as the shale revolution, Ingram said. But no one expected such a thing to happen in the first place. This article is called Opinion. It is entitled, Here's the Why Behind Reflection Ministries' Story, by Lisa Bounds, guest columnist. The lights of the city are twinkling, people are bustling, and the holiday spirit is in the air. You can feel the excitement all around. There is a heaviness that I find makes it difficult to breathe, but a crispness to the air which gives my body a chill. It is mixed with the warmth against my face, and I can feel the wet liquid running down my neck. As I begin to awaken to my reality, the sounds around me are intensely loud with cheering. The cheers, I realize, are for the man who is on top of me, raping me, which explains the challenges I'm having to catch my breath. It is the weight of his body, which fully encapsulates my 100 pounds. The warm liquid is urine coming from one of the other men who just finished raping me. The cheers are coming from the people who have already had a turn with me and those who are waiting for their turn next. As my reality becomes clear and I fade in and out of consciousness, I vaguely remember someone forcing me to drink a beverage, then staggering or actually being drugged to the location. The location is a dark, filthy alley in downtown Dallas. The realization that I was the party favor. My clothing had already been selected and properly placed to hide the bruises from my previous beatings in preceding days. I was learning to be compliant, but it did not appear that anyone cared about the bruises when my clothes were ripped during the night's activities. In no way did I have a choice. I lost count of the men climbing on top of me after about 7, 8, or 9, and began to pray for an end. My whole body was shivering, tears streaming from my eyes. I was becoming numb to the parts of my body that hurt beyond what anyone should ever endure. Then, I felt a hand grab my arm, yank me up, and drag me to the closest fast food chain bathroom. It was there, she assured me, that I had made quite a bit of money already tonight. But the night wasn't over, and I needed to get cleaned up for the next party. Words I had heard all too often. She was another victim, but she knew how to play the game much better than I did, and her beatings were far less. She seemed to have more privileges than anyone else in the house. Most of the time, she was encouraging and supportive, and assured me that it would get easier, that I wouldn't mind after a while, and maybe I would even learn to like it. I never did. I stared at my reflection in the scratched-up mirror of the fast-food chain bathroom. She had locked the door and was in no way allowing me to leave or even consider leaving me alone. At that point, I am not sure it would have even mattered. It was all my legs could do to hold me up as I wiped the blood running from between them, pulled the gravel from my skin because my body had been pressed against the rough alley, and attempted to wash the urine from my face, neck, and hair. She hurried me along, instructing me that he, my trafficker, was waiting, and the night was still young. Looking in a mirror was the last thing I wanted to do. But as I caught my reflection, what peered back at me was a hollowed, brown-eyed girl with no hope, despair, shame, and a wish for death. It wasn't the end for a while in the life of trafficking, but little did I know what would lie ahead in the years to come. This is why Reflection Ministries exists today. You may say it is a calling, a vision, or sometimes I hear she needed a hobby. Reflection Ministries has truly been my personal faith in action and in obedience to what I feel Christ has laid on my heart to see people as people. It is where I found the Lord truly redeems what he allows. My husband Wesley challenged me early on when I finally got up the courage to share my past with him to not build a nonprofit with duct tape and baling wire, but to be thoughtful, intentional, and pay attention to the details, to essentially be me. The journey of this ministry over the past 7 years has been a roller coaster. In the early days, I spent every waking hour researching other organizations, reading every book I could get my hands on, traveling the USA, hosting lunches, meeting with anyone that would give me even 5 minutes to talk about trafficking victims, restorative care services, and everything in between. I had no idea how to create a nonprofit, and some may say I still don't. I don't know that my intention was to build a nonprofit, but my desire was to create a model of long-term restorative care that encompassed crisis stabilization, therapeutic services, identification restoration, education opportunities, and economic empowerment resources with a social enterprise aspect. So survivors of trafficking were met at the moment of crisis and not passed around to multiple agencies. A place they can call home, feel safe, be empowered, and find a group of supportive and caring people in a community to journey through life with them on a daily basis. People that would celebrate their wins, pour into them with wisdom and discernment, and pray with them when life threw challenges at them. I wanted to create for victims what I never had, and what over time the Lord blessed me with in West Texas. Since September 2016, Reflection has designed programs, built and trained a trauma-informed team that provides 24/7 care in an undisclosed, secure location called The Village, opened Reflection Ministries Academy, and created an academic curriculum which also includes life skills, exploitation courses, and vocational training followed by aftercare resources. We have been a part of almost 250 victim recoveries, educated almost 45,000 people in the Permian Basin and across the USA, participated in prosecuting traffickers and buyers, had charges expunged for survivors, been blessed with 5 babies, impacted 66 cities in Texas and 24 states in the USA, and watched survivors become self-sufficient and independent in their daily lives, which results in them finding true freedom. Reflection is the only long-term restorative care organization providing programs that cover crisis stabilization through aftercare services for trafficking survivors for up to 4 years. This is only possible because of you, West Texans who took a chance on a girl with a vision. You have opened your hearts to me, financially supported our programs, and continue to cheer us on and show up for our events. You show us grace when we may not respond exactly the way you think we should. So many of the techniques and our program designs appear to be counterintuitive to how most people feel we should serve trafficking victims. There is always a reason, an extremely thoughtful design, and numerous planning sessions before we implement our programs. We have had many challenges along the way, and maybe if we had to do it over, we would change some things. But most likely, our team would relive it just the same. Only because through every challenge and every win, we have learned how to be a stronger, more trustworthy, trauma-informed team. Thank you, West Texas, for stepping up, as you always do, to meet the many needs of trafficking victims and cheering this team on as we walk daily with survivors. We could not move this mission forward and see lives restored daily if it weren't for you. This column is called Life Tributes. David E. Penick, September 6, 1928, to October 13, 2023. David E. Penick was born September 6, 1928, and passed from this earthly life to his heavenly home to join his sweet Jerry on Friday, October 13, 2023. Visitation will be Monday, October 16th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Services will be held Tuesday, October 17th at 11:30 a.m. at Grace Lutheran Church, with Reverend Robert Pays and Reverend Larry Kruger officiating. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. David was born to Elmer and May Turner Penick in rural Texas and was the youngest of three boys. David met his wife Geraldine, Jerry, while she was babysitting his brother's three girls. They were married June 25, 1950, in Munday, Texas. Those left to cherish his memory are his children, Margie Norton, Fred of Midland, G. David Penick, Paula of Magnolia, Melinda Ludecki, Pat of Belton, five grandchildren, eight great-grandchildren, and two great-great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his loving wife of over 70 years, Geraldine, Jerry Penick, his parents Elmer and May Penick, an infant sister, his brothers Ray and Russell Penick, and their respective spouses. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Youth Fund at Grace Lutheran Church of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Joseph A. Barron. Joseph A. Barron, 60, passed away on Wednesday, October 11th. Viewing will be Wednesday, October 18th, from 1 to 9 p.m., with a receiving of friends from 6 to 8 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral service is set for Thursday, October 19th at 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Guadalupe A. Morales, Jr. Guadalupe A. Morales, Jr., 79 of Midland, passed away Friday, October 13th. The family will receive friends from 6 to 8 p.m., Wednesday, October 18th, at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home in Big Spring. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m., Thursday, October 19th, at the Nally Picklin Welsh Rosewood Chapel. Interment will follow at Trinity Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welsh Funeral Home in Big Spring. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com.
This is Kim, and I'm reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, October 17th. International teachers work hard to adjust. Making up about 10% of Ector County ISD's teacher workforce, international instructors have become part of the district's tapestry. Human Resources Director Sandra Banda said they work with a J-1 exchange visitor company that handles different kinds of visas and has partnerships with recruiters in different countries. When someone from the Philippines or India is interested in an exchange visitor program, they go to a recruiter and say, "They're interested in coming to the United States, Canada, or wherever, whatever country they want to go to." The recruiter has a partnership with a J-1 sponsor. They get their information, they vet them, they make sure that they have met the requirements for the J-1 visa, Banda said. They have to have taught at least 2 previous years in their home country. They have to be a certified teacher, have their credentials up to date, no blemishes on their record, and be able to meet the qualifications for the visa. Once the recruiter submits all of those names to the J-1 company, the J-1 company passes them to us. We go through and we think about what areas we want to support with this initiative, and then we interview them to see if they're a good match for the needs that we have or the goals that we have. Then we allow principals to interview them, and then we invite them to come based on those interviews, Banda said. Many times the interviews are virtual, but they did take one trip to the Philippines before COVID. During that trip, Banda and other recruiters interviewed for 2 straight days from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. back to back. That was really tough. But this year we actually interviewed for a span of about a month. It's tricky because I think the Philippines are like 13 hours ahead of us. A lot of times we were trying to do the interviews as early as we could on our work time, and they were doing the interviews at 10 or 11 p.m. their time, she said. Banda said the ones who are interested in the exchange program are really happy when they're selected to be interviewed. The district also has partnerships with India, Colombia, Mexico, and Ghana, so those are different time zones as well. It's a very vigorous vetting process because the J-1 company wants to make sure that the candidates are high quality, but also we want to make sure that they meet the criteria we have as well for any teacher who's going to work with our kids, Banda said. How well the teachers do depends on the individual and where they're placed. Some countries, for example, do better at the high school level just because they have high advanced degrees. That's what they taught in their home country. The main part that I look for is, what is your experience? What subject area have you taught? We try to match them as closely as possible because we want them to be successful. If they are successful, our kids are going to be successful. That's the approach we take in matching people with the correct placement, Banda said. At one point, ECISD was recruiting teachers from Spain and Puerto Rico. We have not gone to Puerto Rico in a little while. That is on our agenda to look at this year. We actually contacted the universities in Puerto Rico last school year, and the recruitment fair had already happened. They have a major recruiting fair in Puerto Rico in March. So by the time we contacted them in April, early May, they had already had it. So we're on their list for them to send us information, Banda said. The only thing about that is, of course, the travel. You have to pay for recruiters to go interview. They don't do the virtual, but it's very competitive because a lot of districts go from across the United States, not just Texas. We're looking into that to see if it'll be a viable choice for us to continue recruiting there. We do still recruit from Spain every year. It's a good place where people sometimes even return. They came one season and then they went back home to their home country, and now they're back. We have about two of those who just wanted to come back to Odessa, she added. The J1 program is a cultural exchange program. The purpose is to expose children to other cultures, and so the teacher can take that, what they've learned, here back home. Each teacher has to submit a cultural achievement activity every month that they do with their class. They can write letters to students in the home country of the teacher. The teacher can introduce the students to different kinds of food, music, or dances. They're actually responsible for writing up a report that they send to the J1 company that they're fulfilling that part of the cultural exchange program, Bonda said. She added that the program introduces students to how people live in other countries. In Mexico, she said, education is only free through the sixth grade. After that, you have to pay. Initially, the length of the program is 3 years. Thereafter, a district can request for a teacher to stay an additional 2 years on a one-year extension for up to two times, so we can actually get a teacher who's here for up to 5 years on a J1 program, Bonda said. There are a few teachers who seek out H-1B visas, which are another temporary visa based on specialty occupation. The requirements are much, much higher for an H-1B, Bonda said. The candidates who come through the program ECISD works with get what's called a Visiting International Teaching Certification. They meet the criteria for the Visiting International Teacher by meeting the requirements of the J-1. They're a certified teacher in their home country. They have at least a bachelor's degree. They have at least 3 years of experience with the immediate two prior years teaching in their home country, Bonda said. The Texas Education Agency looks at all those things and determines that a teacher meets those criteria, and they can have an international teacher certification for the length of time they are here, either 3 years or 5 years. Anyone who is wanting to stay thereafter on an H-1B has to pursue certification the standard way. That means a bilingual teacher who wanted to stay would have to pass the TOEFL, the English Certification Test. Then they would have to pass the EC through 6 Core, the PPR, the professional test that every teacher takes, the Science of Teaching Reading, the Bilingual Supplemental, and the BPOBT Language Proficiency Test before they can even be considered to be a candidate for an H-1B, Bonda said. The J-1 company has specific criteria that the government has for them for orientation. Once they get here, they are part of the new teacher orientation. They also get a mentor because they're a new teacher, regardless of where they're from, whether they're from Oklahoma or the Philippines. They're new to teaching in ECISD, so they are supposed to get a mentor, Bonda said. Systems of support are different everywhere. I think ECISD has a very systematic approach to ensuring that teachers get the help they need so that they can be successful, regardless of whether they're from here or from another country or from Oklahoma, they're going to get that support, she added. Sometimes they are going to assimilate quickly, and sometimes they may not be used to teaching sixth grade at the middle school versus at an elementary. Everybody who needs assistance is going to get it, Vanda said. The cultural differences also are an adjustment. Some teachers walk everywhere or rely on public transportation or Uber. Others may quickly get a driver's license. What I've seen the most, though, is a lot of them miss their families. It's very hard for them, especially when it's a mother and she leaves her children behind or her spouse. The great thing is that J1s can also bring their spouses and their children on a J2. That takes a little bit of time for the J1 company to get all that paperwork done and make sure everything is up to par with them. It has nothing to do with us, but it's a service they provide, Bonta said. She noted that the J1 company is responsible for ensuring there is an eclectic pool of teachers. They really do have a responsibility to go all over the world, and that's how we end up with teachers from El Salvador, Ghana, Nigeria, so many countries that can offer such a great gift to our kids, Bonta said. Sonia Ayers is an English special education and English as a second language teacher at Bowie Middle School and a house mother for the Chancellor House, where 11 international teachers live. They have to be single. The rent is $600 a month, including Wi-Fi and everything that comes with the house. The other teacher's housing is Killian House. This is Ayers' third year of giving up her time in this role. She said she gets to live rent-free and she never feels lonely with a house full of people. The teachers are in a new country, so they have to learn etiquette, rules of the house, and getting used to all the meetings and expectations, like not driving a car without a license or insurance. Teachers also don't bring sheets or pots and pans. The house provides that, but sometimes they need a little extra, and Ayers will share it with them. She provides answers about transportation and helps them set up bank accounts, what with cooking, writing lesson plans, studying for their certification exams, and many other things. Finding that people are used to eating is another aspect. She may take African teachers to a Nigerian grocery store to help them study for the certification test. She also tries to prepare them for what to expect from the students, who might say they talk funny. Eventually, they get used to the differences. They have people from their own communities here, people from their countries, and so they adjust. Especially the Filipino teachers adjust really well because they have a support group or they have families that's here, Ayers said. Rasha Renacia, an 8th grade math and Algebra 1 honors teacher at Bonham Middle School, is from Dumaguete in the Philippines. This is her fifth year in Odessa, and she is working on getting her visa extended. In the Philippines, she was the head teacher at a senior high school, which is 11th and 12th grade. Renacia said the head teacher position is like a principal. I still wanted to become a teacher, and I wanted to experience something different, so I decided to come to the U.S. I was torn between going to Japan or here, but I decided to come to the U.S. instead, Renacia said. She said the teacher's preparation training is a bit more rigorous in the Philippines. Here it is a teaching certification, but there it is a license. Prospective teachers work off campus their senior year. Since I'm secondary, I took 3 exams for 12 hours just in one day, Renacia said. At first it was challenging teaching middle school because of the culture. How is it in my country is very different. How they treat teachers is very different. You can walk in a classroom as a teacher and everybody would just be quiet and wait for you to start teaching. But here you've got to get everyone's attention for you to be able to teach. It's a very challenging at first culturally, she said. But at the same time, I easily was able to adapt to it because I can relate to how these kids would act, and I kept on telling myself, wherever I go, I wanted to teach how I wanted to teach me. I want it to be fun in class. I want my teacher to be happy, like little things like that. I don't want my teacher to be grumpy in class. I don't want my teacher to get mad for no reason, Renacia added. One of her administrators told her about 3 years ago that the kids don't care what you know. They want to know how much you care. That hit me hard because if I base it on my capacity to teach math, the knowledge I have about the subject and the content, I know I'm pretty good at it. But it made me also realize that that's not enough for my kids. I came here with a full-blown degree. I got a doctorate degree. It got me thinking that's just a plus for the adults, but that's not a plus for my kids. So when I started to understand that, it was easy for me to adjust, Renesia said. At first, all she could think of was that this is not how we do it. This is not how kids should behave. She has noticed that it's difficult for international teachers to adjust. Renesia is a REACH associate through Opportunity Culture in ECISD, so she coaches teachers at Bonham. I'm also assigned to be an international teacher, and I think somehow that's a plus in a way because I can relate to them, she said. Her first year of coaching, she helps somebody from Turkey. Last year, she coached somebody from Spain, and this year, someone from the Philippines. Throughout her time here, Renesia has been amazed at how people who don't even know her go out of their way to help with finding food, furniture, transportation, or anything else she needs. She and teachers she came to Odessa with got mattresses, pillows, and a lot of rice. Someone also gave Renesia a jacket when it's cold. Renesia also has received support at Bonham through Randy Lightfoot, now a talent development coach, remaining her mentor. He always has been my help, and he always checks my class, she said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.